This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Megan Bradshaw. I realized as I was driving up from LA, it's like, so basically tonight we're going to kind of just let you in on a conversation that's been happening for 25 years. Meg and I met in the process of making our film, City of Angels, which we made
25 years ago.
It's crazy. It's 25 years. Yeah. So we were just talking about that. But we do. We just find each other, pick up where we left off, and it's a pleasure. But Santa Barbara gets to meet Meg because Meg is now a denizen of Santa Barbara.
Yeah. And Brad doesn't know this, but my New Year's resolution was to be a part of my community. So I feel like I got some Santa Barbara college swag. And I got a coffee cup and a hoodie.
Yeah.
So I'm in.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so we're gonna dive in. But just a quick question I have. So who's already seen When Harry Met Sally? Okay.
No.
Which means who hasn't seen it? Oh, okay, we're gonna do some spoilers. We're gonna just spoil away for
I've
you.
Seen it once.
But to that point, so this is the beautiful thing. When I talked to Meg about coming to do this, I made a promise to her, which is, so how many of you remember what you had for breakfast in 1989? Right?
Oh, no.
She's like, no Brett, way. Dude, details, I was like, don't worry about it. We're going to keep it global. We're going to keep it global. So we will talk about that. But what I love, it's the legacy of this movie just, again, reasserted itself like a couple of weeks ago. So you were at the Kennedy Center Honors.
Yeah, they honored Billy Crystal for his whole career. And Rob Reiner and I were part of that experience of honoring him at the Kennedy Center. And it was like way up in the rafters. There he was with the president. But I could feel, we all could feel this backstage. He was so blown away. Mm-hmm. And he was in tears half of the time. And he texted me that night. He was so effusive and so happy and so proud of this movie and so proud that it's somehow found a place in people's hearts, you know? So anyway, it was great to be a part of
and
that.
And you mentioned, which I thought was fantastic, that there was actually a build out of a Katz's Deli there.
Yeah. They had a digital projection of it, and then they had, like, you know, people at the Katz's Deli. And I said something like, it's amazing they let me back into this place. And then I said that, like, based on my experience, that Billy is the perfect person to fake an orgasm with. Which is like a joke that was about 30 years in the making, really. You know? After a lot of reflection.
Yes, yes. Oh my God. Well, we'll talk about that scene, amongst others. So, for anybody who doesn't know, the other great thing about this conversation is I'm sitting not only with the co-star of this movie, I'm sitting with a really accomplished director and a writer. And for those of you who haven't had a chance to see this incredible film Meg just made, What Happens Later.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. It's really, and it's available. If you didn't get to see it in theaters, and we'll talk about it because it is the natural extension of grounding the questions these romantic comedies can ask.
Right.
And it's a beauty. It's David Duchovny. It's Meg in an airport terminal.
We are we haven't seen each other in 25, 30 years, and they're snowed in together, and they have to spend this evening, and will they or won't they sort of prosecute what happened, a mysterious thing that happened in their past? Will they talk about it tonight? And the airport is a kind of vessel that is magical and kind of speaks to them, and it, it, it has a kind of magical reality, and it brokers their, you know, continuing. It sounds really like a drag the way I'm talking about it, but it kind of brokers their reunion and this forgiveness that they embark on. And I wrote it. I didn't mean to write it. It just came as a script that, oh well, maybe if we fix the scene or move that, or maybe he could say this. And then it was during the pandemic when I first moved here, and I didn't know anybody and nothing was open, so I was writing. And then it turned, they had come to me to direct it, and then I didn't even want to really be in it. But then it turned out I was in it too. Which was interesting because I had to prepare quite a bit. And Brad was the first on my first call for, what do you do when, oh my God, Brad, I have to be in this thing. I've got a shot list. What's that? You know, and he came up to my house in Montecito, and he brought me these little wooden figures, and he said, if you ever get caught, you can show your DP how you want the characters to move. And so all these amazing little tricks that I didn't have any idea about. So anyway, cut to all this time later. It was a great experience, and I didn't see any footage at all. We didn't have playback on the set, so I didn't see anything till the edit room. So it was a lot of just basic fundamental fear. And then weirdly, I have accumulated after all this time without really knowing it. I think sets, by osmosis, you learn filmmaking. Mm. And that is really how to learn filmmaking. It's really not theory, it's doing, you know. So I had a big course in that just this year, all these years later, all, you know, like a million years after starting. I got to, you know, reach back into my backpack and find, oh, I kind of do know the answer to this. Oh, I really understand somewhere in my soul these questions that
are. And the people skills too.
Yeah.
Because you were navigating, for any of you who are making movies now here or outside of here, the thing that you can't get taught at school is just the people skills. It's like, how am I going to get the most out of this department head, this artist who doesn't get along with that artist, who thinks they should be directing the movie, mm-hmm. who on and on and on. And you have a finite amount of time and energy in your body.
Yeah.
And in her case, she's acting in the movie and she's, but still, yeah, you have to be able to do that. And we had lots of conversations about that.
And we did, and I'm so grateful to Brad for all of those conversations. But ultimately, it became about really setting a bar, because I couldn't micromanage. And as a director, that's all you want to do, is micromanage everything. Because you know that in the editing room, you will have conversations about, should we start the music cue when his eyelid is closing on that blink? Or when it's opening. I mean, it's so incredibly fun, but and all-encompassing, but you find yourself... Anyway, I couldn't micromanage when I was on the set because I was an actor, so I had to figure out how to trust all these artists. And that's the joy that I have always found in filmmaking, that it's an art form by a community for a community, and everything that really happens on the set comes into the DNA of this flickering light that makes you, the audience, feel something. And and it's a mystery. You have your hands in a mystery the entire time, as well as in craft. And you need your friends and you need your community.
Yeah. And to that point of micromanagement, this is why my wife won't talk to me for the first 3 weeks after I finish a movie. Wait, the toast isn't ready. Can you put the toast over there? No, wait. Anyway, yeah. No, we become kind of impossible. So we are going to talk a bit about this movie, though, too, as it relates to the very things we were talking about. And the first thing I want to ask you about is Nora. Mm. So Nora Ephron, who obviously wrote this film, had you met Nora before signing on to the movie?
I don't think so. Don't think so. I was so new in Hollywood. Yeah. And I had done a movie called Top Gun, I think. And I did another little, maybe something else. But it could be that When Harry Met Sally was the second movie that I ever did. And all of it was so new to me. And I guess now I understand the benefits a beginner's mind, which I think you ultimately always have to have. But that's a long answer to your question.
No, that's okay. Well, so it's so, because what's so interesting is, it, and do you, again, from if you recall, was Nora around during production?
Yeah, she was. And she was around. What I didn't understand until much later was that how we did that movie, the process of rehearsal, I thought I would always have this.
Oh,
like,
that's
we
so funny.
Had 3 weeks, and
wow.
we jammed through the script, we improvised around it. We thought, and the whole orgasm scene came in the script. It was that they talk about it in the deli, and I suggested maybe I do it, fake one right there.
Right.
And then Billy had all the amazing lines, and then Rob had all the ideas about how to cover, and it was just a communal, like, I thought that's what movies would always be, and that, it's just simply not that. You know, a lot of times you don't get any rehearsal at all, but this was so, you know, what a luxury to do that, and great things came out of time together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, again, every movie's different, but actual real rehearsal time, very rare. It's very, very rare. And it's not just because it costs or because people's schedules don't allow. There's a lot of directors who are honestly afraid of it.
Rehearsal?
Yeah. Yeah.
What part of rehearsal?
Having to actually have a conversation about the material.
Oh.
And I'm not being too facetious.
That fills in some blanks.
Yeah. Exactly. Now I know why you wouldn't talk to me.
I could never have a conversation about that with that
No,
one.
It's interesting because you, and then others just want it all to be spontaneous. Mm. But for those of you who remember what you're going to be watching again, and for those of you who haven't seen it, I rewatched the movie. I'd seen it a number of times over the years. I rewatched it about 10 days ago. And I just immediately had to reach out to my friend. And so does everybody know the apartment? The Billy Wilder's The Apartment. Incredible movie, one of my favorites. Jack Lemmon has a quality, and it's on display in that movie, in the scene where he's cooking spaghetti and he has the tennis racket and he's trying to keep and entertain this incredible person he cares about from not falling asleep and dying. His ability to embody the physical nature of the comedy and its choreography, its rhythm, but to do so and keep something still grounded, I'm mystified by it. And I watched this movie. There's so many scenes. There's the beautiful, there's an airport scene where you and Billy are on a moving walkway, ironically, for, you know, your movie. And I watched that, and I just, again, because my director's head is kind of exploding thinking about just the time it would have taken on the day to work that out. Mm. And yet it's effortless, it's perfect, and you stay in this character pocket that is remarkable. It's really incredible. It's
she
very
was so
impressive.
Fun to play, you know, now that you're reminding me of her. But she was really so fun to play, like, you know, how she had such a tremendous amount of confidence in the wrong thing half the time. Which is really good. I want to just say one more thing about Nora, because I worked with her on like maybe 3 other movies. You know, she produced something, she directed and written a couple other things. 2 things come to mind, and she was an era. She when you knew her, you suddenly were at dinner parties you could never hope to be at. You were she would give you advice about your life. She was suddenly your godmother. And but all with this kind of like New York restraint that was all back here. She goes, just because you have high-end problems doesn't mean you don't have problems, Meg. And I was thinking about, I was looking for an apartment in New York a few years ago, and I went up to the Apthorpe where she lived, and they had redone all these apartments, and I thought, okay, I'll look in her building. It's a giant building that I think only Murders in the Building is kind of based on.
Oh, wow, funny.
And some of the apartments had been redone and some of them hadn't, and they took me into like 5F, and it was her apartment, and it had not been redone, and it was empty of the furniture, And it was so small. When I remember these dinner parties and these, all these fun when you're in the world of Nora Ephron, you were in this apartment. It was so incredible. Mm. This view that I thought she had of the river was only this teeny little sliver. Yeah. And a few years ago, I went to the Academy Museum, and at the Academy Museum in LA, they have When Harry Met Sally, the script. And I saw all of her pencil notations and her beautiful longhand, and how intricately she thought about rhythm, about timing, about character, about scene structure, about all of these things. It was her, you could just tell by her handwriting how dear this career was to her, to be a writer. And long ago, I tried to write a script, and I sent it to her, and I was like, I don't know if I ever told you this. No. I sent it to her, and I was like, and then do you get that, like, it's that this guy does this, and then his community really does this, and his friends are like, she's like, yes, Meg, yes, that was effective. And then I would say, yeah, but did you see that the climax does come on the right page? And then she goes, yes, it does. I have one note. And I said, but did you understand the end? Yes, I under. She goes, what's your note, Nora? She goes, there is no plot. She was totally right, like 100% right. So that's the genius of this person. That you'll, you know this movie.
She, again, I'm sure there's probably been, you know, 9 different readings, but purportedly, Nora was writing herself. A lot of herself in Sally. Yeah.
Yes, a lot of herself.
Yeah, and Rob was obviously married to Penny Marshall for many years, and coming out of that divorce,
right?
I think I saw a interesting thing with him where he was talking about pitching Nora a movie. He and Andy Scheinman were pitching Nora a movie that she was not interested in writing. So I can imagine Nora being no. But then in passing, mentioned that he was interested in this. Coming out of his divorce, just this question of if it's possible for men and women to even be able to be friends. And,
right.
And she sat up and got very interested. And
it was very meta, too, because he had just met his now
Michelle.
Married to Michelle.
Yeah.
And they were dating on When Harry Met Sally. So he kept going, the movie, my life, the movie, my life.
So,
yeah. Well, and Billy was his best friend, or is his best friend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about that? Rob Reiner, Billy, Richard Dreyfuss, and Albert Brooks all went to high school together.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Amazing.
That's Brad Silberling deep knowledge. I love it.
There's actually a great, Rob made it, which is, it's very affectionate, put it that way. Rob made a documentary about Albert Brooks. I think it's on one of the streamers now. And it's so sweet because they are best buddies and they're just sitting in a restaurant together, but it gives you glimpses of genius that I didn't know. Anyway,
and Rob is also, I think this is another quality that you share with a quality that great directors have. They are fantastic audiences in the moment. They are as tuned in and focused on you, the performance, as possible. And they're feeling you. And I remember Rob next to the camera just trying not to laugh and doing a lot of this stuff. This sweatshirt just always going like this and trying to not ruin takes. But that he's in it with you, like you were, just in it with you.
Yeah. It's the best. It's why, again, I kept checking in with Meg because I couldn't imagine, because selfishly, I want to be literally on that Apple box right next to the lens receiving, willing the next moment on and everything, and for you to be performing in your film and going through that, that's a level of ninja that I, it's remarkable. Just remarkable. Again, just I'll test your memory a little bit. There's the rehearsal period, which is, I'm jealous just hearing about. That's fantastic. And then, but then on the day, there, I'm sure were still great things to work out rhythmically.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think most days it wasn't, I don't think that I don't really recall Rob having already blocked the scenes. Yeah. He had Billy and I and whoever else is in the scene come in and feel our way through it.
Yep.
So there were almost always discoveries. Yeah.
Nice little factoid. The cinematographer in this film is Barry Sonnenfeld, who then went on to have quite a career. He obviously did the Addams Family movies.
Men in Black?
Men in Black, yeah, exactly. Yeah. The Men in Black movies.
And Barry, at the time, would wear every day a different tie.
Yeah, where's his suit?
Like one had a fish in it. And and I think Rob especially loved having him on the set because he was one of the many people, including Carrie Fisher and Bruno Kirby, who just kept the experience lighthearted. And I remember hearing Hugh Grant one time say, doing a comedy is like being a balloon in a world of pins. And it's true, you just want to keep this like kind of just a tone in your life. Yeah. You don't want to have have the pins pop your, you know, this buoyant feeling that you have. And Rob's set was full of really funny, really verbally, with a lot of verbal acuity.
Yeah.
Bruno, Kirby, and that was one of the things that Billy texted me after the Kennedy Center Honors, how much he missed Bruno and Carrie and how as the sidekicks.
Yeah.
Carrie always called herself to me. She always called herself my sidekick. After this movie, we were friends for years.
She's so good in this film too. And again, it's like a Meisner class. The number of different ways she can say, he's never going to leave her.
Yeah.
It's like true to every scene, every setting.
I am having like little blasts of memories now.
That you got to see it. It's a good movie. It's a good movie.
But I remember.
You'll enjoy it.
I remember Carrie, that whenever, you know, they have to mic you, they have to like run the wire up here. I have one now. And they find a place on your body somewhere to put the mic pack. And almost always this happens like on like a street corner or something. And she would always, whenever the sound guy would do that to her, she'd always go, a little more to the right, a little more to the right, a little light. She was just, she missed nothing. No funny, like tee up, she never missed it.
Yeah, no, he seemed to it's funny because I was only reminded seeing Bruno Kirby, and this is really going deep dive, but if anybody remembers Spinal Tap very well, which was Rob's movie, Bruno Kirby plays a limo driver who wants to really wax eloquent about Frank Sinatra, and the band doesn't want to hear it, and it just hurts him.
Yeah.
And I remember that going, what a great little performance. And then obviously he shows up in it.
There's a scene, I think, in this movie that's a four-way phone call.
Yes. The timing on that is remarkable.
I'm just remembering now.
Yes.
That we did this on a soundstage, and we did something like 90 takes.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't a thing where we could, I'm not sure why, but we had four different, I'm on the phone, Billy's on the, what is it?
Yeah, so,
Bruno, Bruno and Carrie are together.
Yes, so it's, they're together, but each on a line.
On a line, right, and
then
they're talking to each other.
So did you shoot, you guys were on set with essentially four camera crews simultaneous, because there would be no way to have the kind of looseness and real sense of judge.
We did it all in real time, like 90 takes, because there was always some problem. One of us would go up, or we couldn't remember the line, or some camera thing.
You hear them yelling across stage.
God damn it! And there was one around take 60, we thought we had it, and then someone was like, they're checking the gate, or they're like, no, bird on that one. It was like a pigeon in the sound stage going, and we couldn't use it.
Oh, my God.
We had to keep going.
It's really impressive. Again, it's one of those things where you just look at now. Yeah, I was thinking, because if you tried to do that mechanically and just time it out, then the actor's just trying to count beats before they say the line.
And
It's a weird business you guys are in. My wife...
You guys.
My wife did a movie. She did a really good movie called Heat. And... she played Robert De Niro's girlfriend in the film who didn't know he was a bad guy, which is like a big miss on her part.
Oh. She's a smart girl.
She's a smart girl. And I just remember we were kind of early in our relationship, and she said to me, "Oh yeah, really sorry. I think the phone's gonna ring at about 3 a.m. Don't worry about it. I just gotta do a thing." And I was like, "What the hell?" And sure enough, there was no call ahead by an assistant director. It was literally De Niro calling her while he's rolling so that he could be having a real conversation
Whoa.
With her. You know?
Wow.
And it was the most surreal thing ever. But this is the lengths that, you know, everybody yeah. goes to.
We'll do it.
I know, exactly. So the 90 takes. Do you remember for the famous Cats scene how many you ended up having to do?
Because
it's
all day.
Did you do all day?
It was all day. And oh. I wasn't all that, like, you know, brave about it, to be honest with you. Like, I was, So, man, Rob's like, come on, give it some gusto.
That makes
sounds.
Me proud of him, because I was picturing him going, go ahead, you know, like not wanting to.
No,
see, today he wouldn't be able to do that.
And, you know, the woman who says, I'll have what she's having
yeah,
is his mom.
Mom.
So he's like making all these sounds over by me, trying to encourage me to have a giant orgasm. And he's like, oh, there's a stove. Oh. He's like, my mother, my girlfriend, my best friend, now this actress who won't have an orgasm.
Well, I'm impressed then, because yeah, no, I sort of figured, oh, you just went for it, and he managed three cameras and
yeah, ultimately you just had to go for it, Brad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you just had to get over yourself.
We had a love scene in City of Angels it's critical for the story, for the plot. It's critical for the story, for the characters, and for Nick Cage, who is an angel who's now kind of literally coming into mortal life, and he's lucky enough to meet Meg. And I remember leading up to that day when we were going to do it.
Was it nerve-wracking for you?
Well, it's funny. What was nerve-wracking was I wasn't sure where I was going to have to try to support the most.
Oh.
And this is the beauty of the journey. I think early on, I might have even been back when we were doing like wardrobe tests. You were said to me, that might be a tricky one. I'm going to be with you. And by the time we got to that day, Meg's like, you gotta make sure he is ready for sports. He's gotta be like, this has gotta be like, and I was like loving it. And she was right, because he was very shy.
Yeah, he's very shy.
Very shy, and you were just like, yeah.
Put your hand right there, yeah, go ahead, come on.
It was the best.
So sexy.
Yeah, no. Liz, it's all choreography, you know, it's always all
yeah,
choreography.
Yeah.
So this is not so much about Rob, but I'm just thinking about this particular art form. Because what's funny is, you know, if they say drama is conflict, you think about great comedy, especially romantic comedy, it has to be like conflict on steroids. Mm. The oppositional forces have to be so great. Otherwise, what's the problem? They get together.
Right.
Do you recall, it's just a question for you on both sides of it, as an actor in with this kind of material, what's the most helpful thing from a director or the least helpful thing?
Whew, that's such a good question. But it with this kind of material, you have to depend on the director's sense of humor. Because often it becomes a very clinical thing where you go, that's funny.
Right. That's what the old comedy writers go,
that's really
funny.
I think we got it. And you're just like, I didn't see anyone laugh, but no, it's good. But you need to trust that. There's a rhythm. It's like a band. I think it's a comedy like this one in particular. Like when you read the script, it was staccato almost, like short things that they said to each other. It had rhythm on the page. Mm-hmm. And that was just a type of, so like an agreement on the rhythm, mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. a basic funny. But I remember being in my trailer. We were shooting up by the Museum of Natural History, and I just know nothing. I think it's my second movie, and I think, you know what? I don't really have punchlines. I have behavior. Mm-hmm. She's behaviorally funny. Mm-hmm. Billy's a much better joke teller than me anyway. So this is a sweet spot. Like, she behaves. She doesn't like her food a certain way. She's very uptight about this. Like, she, it's all about physical. And it's just, it dawned on me probably halfway through the movie.
But that's, yeah, that's your Jack Lemmon.
It was, I like, mean, that, it's behavior.
It's, yeah. And again, yeah, I, not to obsess about the tissues, but the, and it's all through character. That's, yeah, the beauty of it.
And the, like the Aquanet stuff.
Yeah.
That was all, I remember just saying to somebody in the makeup trailer, oh my God, my hair in high school, I used to put like one curl here with the curling iron and one curl here and then just nail it with the Aquanet. And then before you know it, there's Aquanet in the glove compartment. So it's just, that's like a perfect example of being in a band and the music you're playing has the rhythm of comedy. Right. It's a very particular rhythm,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. So flip side, as a director of this, again, your movies, all of these movies are different, but at the same time, especially because you're acting with David as well.
Well, in this case, again, we didn't see playback on the movie, so and we did the whole movie in 21 days for very little money, and we shot in a real airport. It was impossible. But it really became, for what happens later, about sustained shots and trusting the actors. In this case, it's only David Duchovny and I were the only people who talk in the whole film. No one else even talks. And we had to just like take advantage and trust our 10,000 hours that we could, we have 8 minutes to get to this from this part of the airport to that part of the airport and do 9 pages. And we got to have it in like at, 7:20 or something. And those were actually some of the most fun days because it's such a high wire act to be able to hit your marks, know, there's comedic breaks in it. And it becomes, by now, I'm like old. So I know that I have that experience, right? So I can just kind of tell.
Yeah.
And these were, and what happens later, it was all about give them the wide shot, let them just go. And have a little bit of coverage to save ourselves in the edit room. But in our case, we were in the scene together, and he's the only other actor. And if it felt like, I never directed him in the scene, but I could feel like, maybe we should do it faster and then just act faster. And he would,
respond accordingly.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of things in that movie that were ad-libbed too, that we just cracked each other up unbearably almost. So some of the, how much they like, they just don't like each other at all, but they're laughing at each other, That was a tension that was on the set that I think works well in the film.
Yeah, yeah, it's beautiful. And full circle, the end of that film.
Yes.
It's dedicated to Nora,
really, because I'm so grateful to her, and I learned so much from her as a person, as a performer, as a writer. And in order to get a dedication to, and the Directors Guild is rightfully very proprietary about having the directed by credit be the only, the first words you see after the images are gone. And in order to get the for Nora before my credit, I had to petition the Directors Guild. And Brad, of course, was my first phone call. How do I do this? He read my letter to the DJs, like, no. You start over.
Always a director.
And they did. They unanimously voted.
It was beautiful.
I was
on the East Coast, and I had to be present in this. We had this very intimidating room. It's like a star chamber. Purposely intimidated the Directors Guild, the Western Council,
and giant oval,
lot of faces that you know. And so in our agenda, I'm on that committee. That was the crazy. That's why I was so picky with Meg. I'm like, that's my committee. This is not going to fly. Here's what you got to do. So that night I begged them to, cause I was on the other end of the Zoom and I couldn't, it was webinar version or whatever. So I begged them to read it out loud and anyway, it was beautiful because what happened was around that room, not only everybody felt why Meg was doing this, but it became everybody's own relationship to Nora Ephron.
Yeah.
And normally where people would start saying, I'm not sure about this, this is a bad precedent. It was just everybody spontaneously was talking about Nora, and it was unanimous. It was fantastic. Yeah, no, yeah. It was really, really.
Well, I have beautiful. You to thank for that, and thank you.
So here's an interesting question that struck me. This is a fabulous film. There's a few others that Meg made that are in this space, Sleepless in Seattle, and you've got Mail, and Joe vs. the Volcano, which is its
City
own.
City of Angels.
City of Angels. So in the romantic comedy space, if you, because obviously this is Billy, but Tom Hanks has been your scene partner, screen partner on three of those movies. Mm-hmm. Do you each trust that you will just find yourselves anew with those characters in those settings in order to avoid just feeling like, oh, we're just picking up exactly where we left off? I just was struck by that. I was like, oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah, that's a good question. When you, like, I think it's both Sleepless in Seattle and You've Got Mail. We're not really in it a lot together.
Right.
Like, in one of them, I'm in Baltimore and he's in Seattle.
Right.
And then another. So we don't really have that many scenes together. It's right. the right. thing that Nora did, which is you cultivate the yearning for these two people to be together. Like, right. more than they know, you know, the audience. The audience right. knows they're perfect together. And like, right. oh, they should just catch up, those two people on right. the screen.
Right.
So I think she cultivated that. But when it came, like, the movie I did do with Tom, I played three different characters. And he's everything you believe him to be and more. He's so intelligent. He's so generous. And if you are gonna pick someone to fly through the air and on a trapeze and catch each other mid air, you pick him because he's dependable and he's kind and he's funny and he's interested and he's curious and even sitting and talking in between takes. Is enlivening with him. Mm. Yeah, he loves the space program. He wants to talk about World War II. You know, like he's got, got a lot going on.
Oh, amazing. I want to leave time to get some good questions in from everybody else too. So because we're going to keep this up for another 25 years. So.
Years.
That's what we do.
It's my question's actually following up. Firstly, Meg, it's so wonderful to be in the room with you. Thank you for being here. secondly, so we've been talking about Nora Ephron, and I wanted to know, especially now we talk so often in 2024 about female directors, and now you're obviously a female director. What did you learn from being directed by Nora that you apply now as a director yourself, and is that a lesson you can share with us?
That's a great question, and again, it's a kind of an esoteric answer because like it has to do with the kind of hostess she was at dinner parties. Because like a set is I keep saying, it's a community atmosphere where you want everyone to be at their best. And she was very interested in serving good food. Not that we had good food on What Happens Later, but she was interested in all of the whole environment of the set. Was interesting to her, and she, you know, she was very particular about the personalities that she had, like the script supervisor, the DP, everyone had to serve the tone of the story, and we were really careful with that. I made two little movies, and both times I just made sure there wasn't too much gossip in the makeup trailer, because that could kind of like flatten the actors by the time they get to the stage. There's so many elements, but Nora's dedication to that, and also her power was so about her ability to articulate. And sometimes as a woman, that's your power. It's not like bully power. It's she would be kind of withholding sometimes and just go, and you go, oh, that's not going to fly. And she would also fire someone within the first 3 days, which I ended up doing. But not out of necessity on my part. But I saw it because she was like, I'm in charge.
Yeah.
I'm in charge. I'm the director. I'm not going to co-direct with anybody. The buck stops here. I take the responsibility. Ask me. And, you know, her... that was a great lesson. Her sister Adelia said around me one time that being with Nora in Hollywood was like riding around in an armored tank, because she just knew. She knew her stuff. That was another thing. Like, just know your stuff, know your script, know what you want, know those things. Be open for improvisation. Be willing to be delighted. She was always, you know, she had her little hand right here, and she, all she wanted to do was laugh. All she wanted to do was feel something. And you started to understand how simple really it is. You know, we want to cultivate feeling in the audience. We don't want to necessarily teach anything. We don't want to. We want the communal. We want to feel things together. We want to feel less alone. And she was. She mandated that on the set. Yeah.
Yes. This message. This question is for Meg Ryan. I was curious your process once you get the screenplay or the script. Is it? Since you mentioned, you and Brad mentioned earlier, that rehearsals are not the way they used to be, when you get the screenplay or the script, what's your process in remembering this screenplay? Are you using markers? Are you use cue cards like Brando used to use? Or is it mostly recall for Meg Ryan?
That's another fantastic question. But the first consideration is, do I want to turn every page? Is this story compelling me? Do I know what's going to happen next? Am I wondering what's going to happen next? Who am I feeling something? You know, or could we find places to pique those experiences? You know, so like you look at it as a performer, you wonder like, is that in your wheelhouse? Do you want to stretch out of your wheelhouse? Is it time to do something different? So that's part of the consideration. What did I just do before? And then when it comes to understanding the one of the best things that ever got said to me was by Larry Kasdan. And he pitched me a movie and he said, first I'm going to tell you what it's about, and then I'm going to tell you what happens. Which I thought was fantastic because it's like thematic. This is the kernel of what he's interested in. The sentence, as Sidney Lumet will say, like if you can pare it down to a sentence or even an image or some nugget, right? That you're telling the story. You need to tell the story from your gut. That was his first thing. This is what this story is about to me. And when he got into here's what happens, then he's talking about plot. Then he's talking about how your character serves the theme. And then as an actor, I'm very clear. Like, I know what my part is in this. I know what my function. I'm part of his toolkit to investigate this, you know, this concept that is so dear to him. You know, so that movie it was called French Kiss. We ended up rewriting the whole last act while we were on set, but none of us were nervous about that because we knew what it was that Larry was. The essence of what he was after. So I hope that answers your question. It's kind of about essence rather than process. And I did a soap opera a long time ago, and I had to learn how to memorize lines on that. Like every day you had to memorize like 20 lines. So I'm okay at that. I just circle my line. When Kevin Kline does his, when he is figuring out his thing, he told me he just does a highlighter on his line, and everything else is like everything else. Like my line, my line, my line.
Yeah.
Me.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different ways to go, man.
Yeah. It's an interesting, for the writer-director in particular, it's a really interesting, I wouldn't say trap, but for those of you who have made your way through an acting class, there's this term, result behavior. And no performer wants to literally just be handed a result, like say it this way, do it this way. And the tricky part as the writer is you may have a cadence, you may have a rhythm, and yet you're inviting in this group of artists and you have to all, again, get to rediscover. I did a film with Dustin Hoffman, and the first morning he came up to me and I thought it was a trap. It was really funny. He walked up, and his method was twofold. One was he would hand write to be able to get the memorization, he would hand write out his dialogue for the next day's work, that the night before. He would just on a yellow pad. Mm. But then what I didn't realize was he came to me and he walked up, he kind of leaned into me and he said, "Okay, give it to me, give it to me." I was like, "What?" He said, "I just want to hear it, I want to hear it." He wanted me to read his part for the day's work.
Oh.
And I said, "I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. That's not fair." And it was really funny. He said, no. He said, "I made Arthur Miller do this with me.
Okay.
I just want to hear your rhythm. I'll do what I'm going to do, but you got a rhythm and you wrote, there's a thing. Wow. I just want to hear it. I just want to hear the music." So we had this beautiful thing. Like, the set photographer took these great pictures over the course of making this movie where he just kind of be like he's listening to a radio. He kind of leaned in every morning.
I'd
sit and read it. And oh my God, it was the most extraordinary thing.
Wow.
But
you just one more, in addition to that, like for the actors in here, know your words. I like to know all of it before I even get to the first day of shooting. Yeah. Because there's a thing that happens when it's in your long-term memory that frees you up completely. So you're not like worried about, is it or the, and does he say? No, now you're free to be in the scene. You're free to have the other person mess up and you'll be, or you can mess up, but you always know you're safe in the words. So it's just a technical thing, but it will give you a lot of confidence just to know the words.
Yeah, brilliant, very true. As that's going up there, I'm gonna ask another question because I get to. do you remember, did Nora have the if you will, placeholders for those interstitials, the sort of documentary, the old married couples
that structurally? I'm not sure those were in the original script. I just don't remember.
It's a brilliant, it's funny, I felt very jealous of, because it's a great way to leap time. Mm. Suddenly, in terms of the journey with Harry and Sally in their own lives, those become kind of these great page turners without an awkward transition.
Right, and those were all improvised.
Yeah.
So you're right, like, did she mark a spot or was that Rob?
Yeah, that may have just been a discovery.
Yeah, I don't know.
Good accident, it was great.
Yeah.
Hi, I was just wondering what brought you to Montecito and how do you feel that kind of change might have impacted your work or inspired it or something like that?
Oh, well, I was living in New York and it started to feel really bad because of COVID.
COVID.
I had just bought a house in Montecito that 2 weeks before we came out here on March 13th, 2020 or 2019. And I had just had it like demoed, like because we were renovating. So the contractor said, "I can find you a rental." So I said, my daughter, I was like, "Okay, let's we can go out for 3 months and stay in this rental." And you know, New York, it doesn't feel great right now. And we stayed, but we rented a house that was really the equivalent of a cold set. It was like, it was staged and nothing worked. Like the scissors, there were scissors there, but they didn't open.
Oh, no.
And there was one book that was actually was like a staged. Real book, and it was Sapiens. You guys remember, you know that book? And in it, I have to say, it talks about why Homo sapiens, I'm just like really making this short, but why Homo sapiens are the dominant species has to do with storytelling. Yeah. This quirk in our brain development that had to do with holding abstract thought and therefore being able to organize more than 60 people and then maybe believing in a religion. You know, all these ways that, you know, he's really... Anyway, when I read that, I was like, oh my God, storytelling is important. Maybe I'm in the right business. So that's like got me writing, really. Yeah.
Yeah, amazing. No, you've got that good, not a wandering soul, but you're always searching for those homes. And what's awesome is it's like 4 years running now. So
yeah.
You're in pretty good shape.
I'm here. I've been here for 4 straight years.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love it.
Amazing. Awesome.
Hi, Meg. My mom loves you. just had to say that. But I have two questions. One, as a director, how do you know when you've like got the perfect cast? And as an actor, how do you like separate romantic feelings or like create romantic feelings and know when it's like real or fake? Because I feel like a lot of times when we're watching it, like as an audience, we're like, oh my gosh, they would be a perfect couple.
Oh, well,
but then they're not dating. And you're like, wait, what, how?
Yeah.
So yeah, those are my questions.
Listen, I have made that mistake a million times. I'm here to tell you. you know, when you're in your 20s and you're working a lot, those are the only people you meet are on movie sets, you know, actors or no. But, and then you get older and you realize that this is a moment. But it becomes about trust. And then strangely, sometimes chemistry on film, the people don't even like each other. Mm. And there's just something the film picks up, the stock or the something, the light picks up that feels like tension that could be maybe thought of as romantic tension. It's very mysterious. Like, I really don't have a good answer to what you've asked, only that I've made plenty of mistakes that was...
Well, so, yeah, but my wife likes to say to me, okay, so you expect me to create this connection and to have this thing, and then you expect there's nothing else that off gases from that? And
yeah.
I mean, she just, because she was always saying, you know, hopefully one creates healthy boundaries. I mean, it's a really tricky thing.
Yeah.
But it is a thing about that. It's a crazy act because you have to, you can fake to a point. Okay, this is real. Oh, no, I can't.
Is this inside stuff, Brad?
This is inside stuff. Okay. No, I can't. I'm gonna give you the details, but I can't supply the name.
No names.
No names. But I had exactly that what Meg is describing, which is I had a love story where I had two actors who unfortunately probably hooked up before the movie started and fell apart.
That's a mistake, Brad.
That's a mistake. So they hated each other through the making of that movie.
Oh, no.
Hated each other. And we hit a point where, and I kind of both felt like a referee, and at the same time, I'm having to try to capture that chemistry. And late in the schedule, there was finally a very important final scene in this film where the actor is supposed to turn, and he thought he's lost the girl, and he turns, and she's actually there because she's... Da, da, da. And we go to rehearsals, 5 a.m, I'm going to lose the location, and nothing's happening. And I take this young man outside, and I'm like, I don't care if it's an eyelash, if it's a nostril hair. You have to find something to genuinely love. Please. Something. And it was amazing. And he was like a brother to me. And he wells up. He said, I know, I'm so sorry. But when she opens her mouth, I hate her. And I was like, I know. Bring him inside. And this is what directors do, and we have to, you have to be on your feet. I'm like, this is the end of my movie. What am I going to do? So I go ahead, and the scene is staged in such a way that he's looking away and literally going to turn and see she's in the room with him. So I turn the camera, and then the actress is on her mark, and I just know it's, and so I literally take her, I do this to her, and I point to my chair, and I send her over there, and I took her mark. And again, I had this relationship with the actor, like we were like brothers. And I just started talking, and I said, you know, I wrote this movie for you. And you feel his body do this. Aww. And I just kept talking. And he turns, and he's in tears. In the back of my mind, I'm like, I need 3 more seconds. And then I put my arms out, and I'm off camera, and he goes lurching out of frame to me. And that's what's in the movie.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow.
So it's like, that's the thing. Yeah. And so, yeah, boundaries. That was a mistake.
Wow, that's a great answer.
Should not have hooked up before the movie. But I feel for that. And there are actors who, or same thing with directors. Directors are not, my wife always says, oh, your job is much more intimate than mine. You know, you have to have this relationship with your cast. And that's really quite
something. That's an interesting point. Yeah, one of the joys of being a director is that you're in on it with everybody. My other little movie had Sam Shepard in it. And just to be inside and like hear what his process was, or there were a lot of other little kids in that movie. And I remember taking him out to dinner before we started, and I don't know anything what I'm doing, and I can't believe he's doing the movie. And I say, Sam, how do you work? Like, are you a method guy? Do you want to talk about backstory? He goes, backstory. The great American playwright.
I was going to say,
and I'm like, oh, now what? He goes, I just don't want to see one thing. I said, what's that? He goes, fear. You know, I was like, sweating. And I just don't want to see fear in anybody's face. And I'm like,
no worries. Oh, yeah. My God.
But anyway, you are in on it in a really interesting way with your actors as a director.
Yeah. And you're spinning plate, and the more you do it, you are thinking of the edit. That's what's so funny is all of these moments that can happen. Somebody loses their temper. Somebody this, that. Somebody falls asleep on camera. Who knows? But it's like, ooh, okay, I can take that and I can put it in the movie. So...
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.